The United States has to find a way to get these people out as a matter of priority.
Tensions rise as the world awaits the next move on North Korea. It's Wednesday, April 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're online right now on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Australia and New Zealand mark a solemn anniversary. We meet a Cambodian family who found a better life in the United States. Dancing to music by a South Korean guitarist. Underwater robots and a new way to learn dentistry. We're just getting started. Stay with us for VOA Asia. North Korea has marked the 85th anniversary of the founding of its military. South Korea's defense ministry described the observance Tuesday as, quote, a massive fire drill in the eastern port city of Wonsan. Some observers expected the nuclear-armed country to honor the anniversary with a sixth nuclear test or a missile launch. Neither of those had occurred by the evening. The celebration came on the same day as a U.S. nuclear-powered submarine, the USS Michigan, arrived in South Korea, and the navies of those two countries joined Japan in conducting military exercises in the waters west of the Korean Peninsula. The naval exercises are scheduled to last through today as U.S. President Donald Trump speaks with all 100 U.S. senators at the White House for a special classified briefing that will primarily concern North Korea. Meanwhile,
clearly, we've got to do more. The United States has to find a way to get these people out, as a matter of priority.
That's Phil Robertson, Deputy Asia Director of the advocacy group Human Rights Watch, who says Washington needs to find some back-channel way to establish a working dialogue with Pyongyang to negotiate the release of Americans being detained in North Korea. Korean-American Kim Sang-duk, also known as Tony Kim, became the third American to be held in North Korea when he was arrested Saturday at the Pyongyang International Airport. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley says Kim's arrest is an attempt by the, quote, flailing Kim Jong-un government to gain some leverage to deal with the United States over its nuclear and missile programs. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with John Wolfsall, a special assistant to former U.S. President Barack Obama as senior director for arms control and nonproliferation at the National Security Council. In that post, he was the most senior White House official setting and implementing U.S. government policy on all aspects of arms control, nonproliferation, and nuclear policy. Wolfsall discusses escalating tensions and how they're different from North Korean flashpoints in the past.
Well, I do think that there is a tremendous amount of risk on the Korean Peninsula, and I think that rhetoric both in Washington and Pyongyang have made that worse. I think people who are just turning back into the show need to remember that there have been tensions on the Korean Peninsula for well over 50 years, and it goes through cycles of tension and then relaxation. But this is a cycle unlike something we've seen for many years, and there is a great risk that it could get out of control and lead to open conflict.
Well, everybody's asking the reason why has it reached this level. The Trump administration has ratcheted up the level of brinksmanship that has been the role of the North Korean leadership of has. What kind of effect might that be having?
We have to be cautious because we don't really have very great insights into North Korean thinking, but there's no doubt that the change in America's tone and our approach to the Korean nuclear problem has really put a lot of our allies in the region on edge. And has put China on edge in a way that we've not seen before. There are some who believe that this brinksmanship might actually put pressure on North Korea to come back to the negotiating table. But the, I think, more likely result is that this will undermine North Korea's sense that it is secure, that the United States is ever going to accept them as a legitimate state and lead them to cling to their nuclear programs more tightly, and perhaps even lead them to try and out-Trump Trump by taking action to put the United States back on its heels. So traditionally, America has played the calming role, has tried not to let tensions get out of control. But clearly under President Trump, as in so many areas, we're going to be trying something new. And the challenge is whether or not we can keep a lid on things.
Well, what is the reality as you see it as to whether or not Kim Jong-un could carry out some of these threats that he's making?
North Korea has, over the past 15 to 20 years, developed a small arsenal of nuclear weapons. They've been able to miniaturize them to the point where they can likely put them on short or maybe even intermediate-range missiles that can reach all of South Korea and Japan. What they have not been able to do is develop a long-range nuclear missile that can put a nuclear payload on the United States, something that they have said they wanted to do for many years and something that they likely believe will deter the United States from either attacking the North or for protecting our allies in a crisis. But we also have to keep in mind that in addition to its nuclear and missile capabilities, North Korea has a massive conventional army. It has thousands of pieces of artillery that we saw in action during the live fire episode that are within range of Seoul, a city of 25 million people in which 100,000 Americans live. So this is a very tense situation. There are a tremendous concentration of military, both conventional and non-conventional capabilities in the region. And I would argue that the United States has a strong incentive to try to calm the situation as opposed to try and create or exacerbate a crisis.
Have you seen any hints so far from anyone in the Trump administration that that is the way they might be going?
It has been interesting to see the evolution of Donald Trump's rhetoric over the past several weeks. His meeting with President Xi Jinping in Florida appears to have convinced him to let the Chinese have some time to work the North Korean problem. China has offered and tried in the past to calm U.S. concerns and to convince the United States to be more patient with North Korea. But that's in large part because China doesn't want to deal with the potential risks that a conflict in Korea might have for it. There's the potential that you might have up to several million refugees flee from North Korea into China, and there would be tremendous economic and security disruption should there be a conflict on the peninsula. So China has basically decided it can live with a nuclear North Korea as long as it doesn't lead to a conflict. I think that the Trump administration has been willing to be a bit more patient, but I think it's still likely that we're going to see uncontrolled or uncoordinated statements coming out of the Trump administration.
John Wolfslaw, former senior director for arms control and nonproliferation at the National Security Council. These are among some of the top Asia stories that are trending on voanews.com. U.S. nuclear sub arrives in South Korea amid North Korean threat. Americans arrested in North Korea remain pawns in nuclear standoff. Australia, New Zealand mark memorials to war dead throughout Asia. Chinese takeover bid for U.S.-based MoneyGram is scrutinized. Winner of Green Nobel says India plundering, not protecting tribal lands. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Tens of thousands of Australians and New Zealanders paid tribute Tuesday at memorials and graves for war veterans in remembrance to the price paid in conflict in more than a century of wars. During the First World War a century ago, the two nations fought together under the name Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. The First World War left an indelible mark in the Australian consciousness. More than 60,000 Australians died, 156,000 were wounded, gassed, or taken prisoner during the conflict, with the fighting forces coming from a national population of fewer than 5 million. Australian Ambassador to Thailand Paul Robillard at a dawn memorial in a jungle shrouded gully cut by Allied POWs over 70 years ago spoke of the symbolism that accompanies the memorials.
On this 102nd anniversary of the Anzac landing at Gallipoli, let us all reflect on what the Anzac spirit means, the spirit of service and mateship, the firm belief in democratic freedom, being prepared to make even the ultimate sacrifice to protect the rights we enjoy.
During the Second World War, almost 1 million Australians served in the armed forces from Africa, the Middle East, and Europe, and in Asia as Japan's imperial forces threatened the Australian continent. Remembrance services were also held in Singapore, Malaysia, the Philippines, Myanmar, and Laos. In Vietnam, where 60,000 Australian troops served alongside United States and allies during the Indochina conflict from 1954 to 1975, memorials were held in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City. Bob Hall, a Vietnam veteran and history lecturer at the University of New South Wales, said the day is a reminder of those lost to conflict.
For me, it's a reminder of mates that I lost in Vietnam. It's not much more than that. It doesn't tell me much historically. It tells me about the personal side of loss in war. But that's, you know, that's just me.
Martin Stewart Fox, Emeritus Professor of History from Queensland University, said conflicts often called by politicians leave the suffering to be borne by ordinary people.
We send people out there to fight wars, wherever it is, and they fought them to the best of their ability, and they were our representatives in doing so, and we should honour that. So I think these occasions should be celebrations of the discipline and the courage and the honor of those that were thrown into the fight.
Our thanks to all who served and to Ron Corbin for bringing us this report. Happening now in Asia, the United States and China will conduct four rounds of talks prior to President Trump's visit to Beijing later this year. Denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula and addressing North Korea's threat are expected to be high on the agenda of Trump's visit. The first round will be in Washington. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad that you're with us today, listening to VOA Asia. Thank you so much for joining us. Chap Cong's diplomatic career ended 42 years ago this week with a U.S. Marine airlift out of Cambodia as the Lon Nol regime fell to the Khmer Rouge. In a new land, the family began life with very little as refugees. VOA Asia's Steve Miller spoke with Kin Sing Men of the Khmer service here at the Voice of America about their new lives in the United States and how Chap's eldest son has given back to his adoptive home.
After arriving in the United States, what was Chap Cong and his family's adjustment period like?
It was tough for him because life as a diplomat, as you know, in Asia, they get a very special treatment. You have everything at home, people to help you. And when he got to the U.S., as he said, they were trained from basic things, from cleaning the toilet, washing dishes.
Having to do everything themselves.
Exactly, yes, yes. And also looking for a job that can feed them and can feed the family. And it's pretty tough, but he managed by and found some decent job to do in the U.S. And he was put in California from day one until today he's still there.
Now, his family, it's not just him and his wife, correct?
Yes, him and his four kids. Yeah, the fifth one was born in the U.S. Yeah,
amazing. So the nugget of your article is about his eldest son, Song Kun Tir. What can you tell us about him?
He's the eldest son of Mr. Chap, and he came here as a boy, 12 years old. Also, you know, son of a diplomat, getting a spoil in
used to some of the finer things in life.
Exactly. And then here he had to do most of the basic things that kids here do, walk to school, study hard at school, and also learn a new culture, a new language. And But he loved to become a pilot. But when he applied to it and he didn't pass it, so he ended up working for the for U.S. Navy.
So why did he choose to then go into the Navy if his goal was to be a pilot? I mean, I understand he didn't qualify for the pilot, but there are other armed services.
That's a very good question. He see that two reasons. One was he liked the job for sure. Second was being in the Navy, you were given a scholarship that you can go to study at a college. That's these two main reasons that he decided to join the Navy.
What is he doing now in the Navy?
Oh, he is a commander in one of these Navy Reserve in Hawaii. Amazing life from, you know, losing the job as a diplomat 42 years ago, and now his son moved up to a commander in the Navy, make the whole family pretty proud of him and also the community.
Do they still get the opportunity to visit one another that often?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The last time they met was this weekend when they celebrate Khmer New Year together.
Kim Sung-mun is with our VOA Khmer service. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A Chinese court sentenced Sandy Fan Gillis, a U.S. citizen, to 3 years and 6 months in prison for espionage, but then ordered her deported. Fan Gillis was arrested in March 2015 while about to leave mainland China for Macau and had since been held without charges. VOA Asia Facebook has all the big stories throughout the day. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. South Korean guitarist Jinlu Lee hasn't necessarily been, quote, kissing strangers, but she's been playing very close with her dance rock band colleagues, who now have a new single. Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossings, joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to tell us more.
Today we're talking dance. Actually, what we're talking is DNCE, so they left the A out. It is a band that was put together by former Jonas brother Joe Jonas, and they've had a few hits, and I'm sure you probably heard Cake by the Ocean. They followed that up with Toothbrush, and now they're back with a brand new song. They're currently on tour promoting their debut album, which came out last year. It's called DNCE. But the new one features Nicki Minaj, and the song is called Kissing Strangers. It just came out, so we're going to listen to it right now.
Is this a new partnership with Nicki Minaj? Have they worked together before?
No, they haven't worked together. They have their own band. It's a foursome. Joe Jonas is the guy that put the group together. Actually, Joe was primarily the lead singer of the Jonas Brothers, along with his brothers Kevin and Nick. Then they broke up beginning of last year and went in separate directions. DNCE released a song, probably tongue-in-cheek because they didn't have an album at that time, called Cake by the Ocean. But the song hit top of the charts, sold millions, and everybody took them seriously. So they decided, well, you know, we better put out an album. So they have recorded a full studio album. They're touring for it right now. And when Joe is not busy doing touring and singing, he's been hired as the body, the face, the spokesperson for the Guess underwear line. So he said it's been a lot of hard work for him getting his body in shape for underwear ads, but he doesn't mind that at all. But this group is kind of an international group because it features a Korean guitarist whose name is Jinju Lee, and she's very talented. She's been a part of other groups and been a session recording guitarist for other groups as well. Very talented. So I really like their sound. They're an upbeat, happy, you know, up-tempo kind of group, DNCE. And the new song is great, but this is their first collaboration with another singer.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I'm kissing strangers.
Developing at this hour in Asia, Philippine security forces killed about 36 Islamic State-linked militants in a three-day air and ground assault on the main southern island of Mindanao. The armed forces of the Philippines also said two remaining Abu Sayyaf bandits on Bohol are fighting for survival and are no longer a threat. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook at VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, in many parts of the world, invasive species contribute to the destruction of local ecosystems, including the lionfish, a voracious predator from Asia that's now in the Caribbean. VOA's George Pudich looks below the surface at a new underwater robot on the frontline fight against invasive species.
A voracious predator itself, this exotic venomous beauty is prized both by chefs and aquarium enthusiasts. The fast-breeding lionfish started showing up in the Caribbean in the 1990s. Biochemist and entrepreneur Erica Ebo says it has quickly become a big problem in Bermuda. She spoke to VOA via Skype.
They replicate at a ridiculous rate. So one lionfish can lay 30 to 40,000 eggs every 3 to 4 days.
It has had no natural enemies in the world it invaded until now. A remotely controlled underwater robot recently tested in Bermuda is hunting the hunter, showing off an innovative way to stop the lionfish's killing spree among smaller fish that clean corals in the Caribbean. It was designed by Robots in Service of the Environment under the motto, "You have to eat them to beat them." With two extended arms serving as electrodes, the robot named Guardian, remotely controlled from surface, stuns the lionfish with a quick jolt of electricity before sucking it into its chamber. Next stop, the kitchen.
We need to figure out how to catch the fish, how to bring the fish into the ecosystem of supermarkets and dining rooms around the world. And by doing that, we have a fighting chance to solve this horrible problem.
At the robot testing event, visitors could taste the lionfish prepared in different ways. Executive chef Rob Ruiz, who also spoke via Skype, says lionfish is also interesting from another point of view.
These robots in service of the environment can show that they have a significant cog here within marine protection, within preservation of species, being an effective tool to restore the equilibrium in a particular ecosystem, in a particular ocean, at a particular time.
Builders of the Guardian admit their robot won't make a big dent in this massive problem, but say a more affordable machine could help local fishermen keep lionfish on the menu and provide them with steady income. George Pudich, VOA News, Washington.
Back on dry land, the world of virtual reality is keeping dentists in training out of your mouth by using relatively new technology. It's called mixed reality. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us more about where the virtual world meets the real world.
The patient doesn't complain, but that's really the only difference for these dental students practicing in the world of mixed reality. The mixed part of the process is this dental training head. It's not much to look at. And without the virtual reality goggles, it's even less impressive. But when you place the VR over the fake head, a process called augmented reality, suddenly it's a real mouth and a real person.
I hope this technology will give more visual information and help students imagine and understand what needs more caution during practice surgeries by revealing more information on non-visible areas. This is something a textbook can't offer.
The developers hope the training program will make dentists more comfortable with patients and let them practice all kinds of different dental scenarios.
Usually, we would have to use our imagination to determine the area that needs treatment and then sync that information with what we are physically seeing in our patients, a process that requires experience, intuition, and good sense. But the merit behind this technology is that anyone can see the same information and implement treatment safely.
The developers say this is the first time virtual reality simulation has been successfully paired with augmented reality. The Merida team says they expect to have a product ready for universities and hospitals in about 2 years. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
And as the new dentists become more comfortable with their patients, I'm sure it works the other way around as well. You've been listening to VOA Asia. We have many ways for you to get our program, including on iTunes and SoundCloud. Check it out. We're also a podcast. Download our program and take it with you wherever you go. We'd like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jim Harmon, for helping us bring this program to you today. Our managing editor is Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team includes Steve Miller and Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.